This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Some kind of context or some kind of beginning. In other words, I'd like, if it's agreeable with you, to ask you what you would like to work with, or what you'd like to discuss, or what you'd like to question or bring up as questions. Anybody want to start off? Anything that you're curious about or want to talk about further that we've touched on? Anything? I think it's very apropos. I think it's very much the underwriting sense of possibility we've been getting to. I was looking, if you read these, well, not to, no, because after all, these are, so to speak, serious, in effect, a serious attempt to deal with the fact of any kind of writing. And if you read this, you can perhaps see for yourself where there is a kind of blur where the intention isn't clearly understood. As Robert was saying, look at all the truths. That's very curious. Because let's take, who's responsible to discuss this question of consciousness?
Excuse me. I was wondering between poetic, personal, and national.
Poetic. I question that there may be a difference again in the place of, in other words, when you say national consciousness, that has relation to the, say, to the form or to the presence of a group of people, a society of people. But I wonder if consciousness can ever be other than particular.
Yeah, when I was, for instance, I was trying to press for the poet being different from the, being a person in and of himself in addition to your own personality. But the consciousness is a simple thing in which any of these things can be. In other words, you can be conscious of this or unconscious of it. And in the consciousness, then, so that any a question of, as the one raised about fourth dimension and so forth, is an affair of consciousness, and the business of writing is bringing things into consciousness. All our ideas of any things or anything seen that we identify, or even our idea of the unconscious, is in conscious engagement, because we talk about it, we draw pictures of it. And that is actually what our consciousness is. And our consciousness may very well, for all we know, be making it up. I mean, imagining it. So that the realm we are dealing with in writing and even in speaking has to do with the minute we're trying to focus and see what it is, has to do with an expanding consciousness. But we are aware that then we are aware that it has imaginative or unconscious directives, because we see and feel patterns that are very difficult for we perform on simple patterns that are very difficult for our consciousness to cope with, and so that in writing a poem, if we just take the affair of consciousness itself and the fact that it can be a hazard when you're writing too. The struggle that you have to learn to ride something. The consciousness has to learn to ride something in order to ride. Now, some of the differences that you have between Bob and myself and Alan will really be on how that consciousness has learned to ride a kind of force so that it can be at home in the language. And then when we talk about stoppage, it's really the consciousness really finds, I'm not going to ride that way. It can't change. At least in my feeling of the force is, again, nature the force itself is like the consciousness whole, so it can't change the force. It's some sense just as much a life sense of not writing, I guess. Is that too? You look really puzzled. What did you want?
I'm
asking about
personal consciousness.
Yeah, and the poet. No, because don't put national and personal as adjectives. Think of person and nation in the consciousness.
What do you mean by national?
Yeah.
Let's take an instance.
Anybody said national consciousness?
From well, that's true, but it's always.
Yeah.
National mood is more or less like, how does everybody feel?
Oh, I see what you mean. Like when I was trying to say we may belong to a larger mind.
Oh, and but, there's nothing wrong with being a soft-brained
Yeah.
No.
No.
Well, it can be coherence. I was thinking of this instance of the feeling that occurs, say, after Lincoln's death, as the train carrying his body moves across the country, and you have, in effect, a quote, person, unquote, instance, Whitman's direct, well, expression of the instance of Whitman's consciousness. Then you have, in effect, a quote, nation, unquote, consciousness that I feel it's part of the same thing. In other words, I don't.
He felt his own real deep feeling, and his own real deep feeling is probably very similar to what the deep feeling of a lot of other people, but they are not so consciously conscious of it. So he expresses it, and that touches the naked string over the same thing.
Well, see what does an effect obtrude, or what gets in the way of this would be the particular forms which are external, or the habits of form. I was thinking again of these proposals, which are after all proposals of patterns of feeling, directives of the feeling, prior to the instance. In other words, so that you have consciousness of. Continually modified and being modulated by the particular term of the person, e.g., where they live, the whole environmental business. But the consciousness is to my mind, part of the whole totality of a life force.
Yeah, and that life is going to include.
It cannot be separate.
Let's say your personality, that you. Just that level itself has formed purely from the things around it, and consequently can be viewed not as. I mean, we could say either it comes up from you in order to live surrounded by these people, but it can also be said to have been made by an imprint by all the people around, so that it begins to be a communal thing, and our community is changing. I think Alan is right when he talks about our being, the thing that's disturbed our sense of nationality is that our actual community now is a world community, and we find at every point crises where a completely non-true form, the old nation, is not big enough, but also it isn't even a question of big. It's the fact that we come into contact with things that are beyond the boundaries that we used to draw. Into living contact, so that the things outside those boundaries are making us, so we can't be decently said to be any longer North American or American. I mean, in the sense of USA or Canadian. These boundaries don't fit our actual being because we're coming in contact all the time with things that are also our parents that lie in remote parts of the world. And if you just take information-wise, the fact that we know right away and consequently have something happen to us when the radioactivity increases so that the caribou are dying. We have to do with tundra and caribou and Eskimo. I mean, yes, but we do, because even to have the information. Think of a more closed world. It didn't have the information. It has to do with the time the information takes to come to you. Now, you're right that all you'd have to do to be able to live in a small world would be to blow the whole thing up. Blow up the communication so you wouldn't know what was happening. It's that simple. You wouldn't know what was happening in the next town. One thing I observe about newspapers, they're always local about the murders, so that really juicy, sensational crime. So you keep thinking, I'm living in a hot spot of crime, and nothing's happening in Fresno. Well, this is a local California reference, but you pick up a Fresno paper, and they're living in a hot spot of crime. People are murdering each other. Everything's healthy, you realize. Children still murdering parents, and everything's going the way you know must be for a fairy tale. This world actually, so there is some sort of, since we are opening up more and more and more, and with more and more demand also to be able to move from language to language. In other words, the area, you could sit and draw your own area, but no one here in the room, I suspect, could draw a little town like Emily Dickinson could think of. And as a matter of fact, we lose the intensity of the little town, and when you're in the little town, we become consequently deranged from it, because everybody has such a complex of information that are shaping them that the little town itself begins to be a very hard place to live. Not that it was ever easy. I mean, because you had a given, say, 100 people that you knew and that you weren't actually that akin. You had to accommodate and take sides and shape up a very different little configuration. Now that one's gone, because we tend in any large city to know those people that we get along with better and better, and then we can avoid the ones that don't come to us.
Well, I'm curious about how you think it's not just a kind of formula, which is an unhappy one, but consciousness leads to action. Now, what I'm curious about is what, in poetic terms, as opposed to the form of action you're most concerned with, or that you have this expanding world consciousness, the local forms are no longer possible, yet what's pretty clear is that the world consciousness is too large to grasp concretely.
Well, I just mean that you have the consciousness you have, not a world consciousness, but one that goes out there.
I think that when you say, Fred, for example, that world consciousness is too large to be grasped, you're actually speaking of a proposal of its form. You're not speaking of its actual character, but rather of a proposal of the form, which is always given locally. In other words, it's a local characterization of consciousness. Now, that we were talking last night, for example, apropos the fact that Japanese and Russian fishermen are now have taken over all the halibut grounds to the north, and so that the halibut industry along the coast here will be, unless something extraordinary happens, will be finished in a very short time. This is with the agreement, apparently, of the interests which control, say, the relationships of American and Canadian fishing interests in these waters. And then there are instances, for example, 7 million pounds of frozen halibut again, showing up in Chicago, selling at 25 cents a pound, packaged and ready to go to the retailer. Then, as Olson was citing, a similar instance of the same thing happening in Gloucester. Now, this is, mind you, at the same time, say, less than a year ago, we were given the occasion of a, quote, world crisis dependent upon relationships between Russia and the United States. Now, this, you see, this is my point, is that this relates to this concept of world consciousness getting out of our hands. In other words, it's impossible that these two conditions should exist simultaneously, except in the imagination. You see, it's simple. And again, my point is just another instance of the use, the form which the consciousness has proposed for its activities. In other words, I believe now, personally, that all consciousness is local and is located in persons, and that its uses are divergent or change in given environments, but that there is not more nor less of it in this extraordinary sense. In other words, that the grasp of reality is always located in a person. I mean, I think of Williams's sense, a new world is only a new mind, or rather a new instance of either an increase of perceptive possibilities or the uses of perception, but it is not a form which ever exceeds a person. Ever.
It does appear that the one has a sense that the invert comes from Calcutta, and this is not an unusual experience here.
Yeah.
There are people that talk to each other across national barriers in a way that they haven't years.
Yeah.
Somebody who is a local in New Jersey can shift to Calcutta and not feel the shift quite the way they did 20 years ago.
But this, you see, to me relates to the form rather than to the base of consciousness itself. In other words, how he can't. We look at a television set, for example, and we were talking about that last time, and we see a picture. We see this electronic reproduction of some event in Calcutta, and we don't respond to that as we would, say, by being there ourselves as person. I believe that our relationship is a one-to-one ratio always, and that we are only consciousness is local to person. It is not is extensive in its form, or in its literal in terms of the energy factor, but it is not extensible as a construct, then which comes over you like a quote sky or some blanket of extra personal cover. In other words,
if you read it, the late 19th century poem, consciousness is specifically local. And the intention, in some large sense, is to arrest some other person's consciousness.
Yeah.
Simply to grasp it and make him see.
Yeah.
If you read Ferlinghetti's poem on Berlin, the intention is somewhat larger,
more than
simply to arrest the person on a scene.
But in that particular poem, for example, all the mode of feeling is located in either Ferlinghetti's person or in the person of a general player, for example. It's there is no reference that exceeds anything more than one or one person. In other words, there is no location of a meaning or of an effect beyond the literal term of a person.
Yeah, but the concept is rather than arrest the consciousness on beautiful scenes which the person is trying to create an ideal, the shift in poetry that is invisible is toward sometimes obvious. The object is not just a contemplation, but he's got that sticky candy going. And he wants you to be upset by this whole situation.
Well, I think in either case, say either the 19th century, I was thinking something like, let's take I Met Murder on the Way, wore the face of Castlereagh. I was thinking Shelley, which was akin to Lawrence's poem where he's citing it. I think it's simply the vocabulary is shifted, but I don't think the base feeling of the consciousness itself is shifted, except that it's when you have an effect, when the world is located in pockets of small, relatively small community terms, that is your hometown, or very small, as Emily Dickinson, where it's literally your house and your backyard, then the vocabulary is different insofar as literally the term of expression is located in those in what is then the immediate particulars of that environment. Well, our environmental terms are simply
I didn't mean
extended.
Though the poem was lived in the area, because I don't think, I mean, after all, Emily Dickinson had the business of eternity.
Yeah.
The thing I meant was her consciousness the consciousness was in a different area. And we all of us know on the same terms where our consciousness is, regardless of who we are. I mean, we all know, all you have to ask yourself is, where are the boundaries and how far out does that information go? But the poem certainly does something else, because what then does the imagination do? Jaime D'Angulo, an old man who had been converted to Navajo, I think it was, I mean, I'm not sure what Indian rites, but he did say of the imagination, he said, but there's no window here, well, there's an open door. He said, you can see everything that you see there through the door, but the imagination has every right, and you see a man walk by, and what your consciousness knows is that you saw that he was there, and then he went to there. But from there on, he could go around the world three times, or he could have turned into a hobgoblin, he could have done anything, and the imagination occupied that area. The one that you don't know, where the imagination doesn't occupy, and that's what we've been pressing, is the one where you see him. Don't turn him into a hobgoblin when you see he is what he is. But the hobgoblin is awfully important in the human world. The thing that's behind the cloak. Well, as a child, I used to scare myself until I was quite ready to collapse by what I could put behind a. I never put roses and lovely things behind those the closed door. Although many children's stories open the door and it's a garden, but what used to be behind there would be terrific. And it wasn't unreal. I've lived with it, you know, long enough to know it wasn't unreal. But you open the door, and then you can see what's on the other side. The other margin, when you have crushed, when the imagination is defeated, at the point when the reality is defeated, when you open it up and the hobgoblin says the imagination collapses, and reality has collapsed, the whole system has given up. But in the poem particularly, we are always producing pictures of what we don't see. Now, we did talk about the fact that while we can get news, and this is on a very widespread trust that radioactivity, which we don't, which I don't understand, so it's got some of that hobgoblin to it, and the Eskimos, which I don't understand, so they become active in lots of ways, and so even a newspaper can get you very excited, and it's hard to locate what happened, because it's way up there, and distance there, like going into the past, distance and time, in a funny way, it becomes more you, and it's way, way, way off in there. The thing that you keep thinking is inside you is way off in the periphery, in Eskimo land in Africa, which you, now Africa is almost becoming de-Africanized because we're constantly getting pictures of Africa that are behaving just exactly like us, so they no longer are charged with this noumenal quality of what is not like you and can then become a kind of, is it a mirror? But the shaman part of the poem, when you talk about consciousness in fourth dimension, how does consciousness go out and bring into consciousness pictures that no longer... that no one would dream have anything to do with finding reality, and yet they're posited on reality because if there isn't it, well, if you take a case history of a person who's insane, they begin to actually clutch reality because these two things become more and more vivid, more and more concrete as you as an agency between them become more disturbed, and poetry is a way of making. So that the table does become almost, now I'm thinking, my mind always at this point goes back to Burma's illumination, which he looked at a pewter picture and actually saw the pewter picture, that's what he saw. But he saw it in some way that was charged with its being that had erased almost everything else. Where he was, it became a gate that, because... It's concreteness. It's more than ordinarily you take it for granted. Then the next step is to recognize and have to do with pewter and know its terms or paint it like a painter and it will increase in reality, but it'll also increase in being charged with the imagination that, I don't understand a thing about the fourth dimension except that in some way it has to do in my mind, and believe me, patient people have explained to me, please don't use that term where I'm not, or I've even read over and over and over and found myself not. But this funny gateway thing, we do have a dimension. We all of us have a potentiality, and at that point of transition or trembling or shivering, this reality increases. Well, if you fall in love, the reality of the person you fall in love with both increases and their unreality increases because you're feeding in. I mean, they also become phantasmal at the very moment in which their physical reality becomes actually overwhelms you. And Burma fell in love literally with this pewter pitcher because it became a door. And then this is, these have been called, always been called doorways to God, which is out there, bigger and inside. More insight than all these persons we draw, the consciousness or unconscious.
So, I think one of the things that is involved is that we always feel and know and are aware of more than we are conscious of. But, you know, there is an unconscious. Yes? Everybody agrees with that. I mean, everybody is aware of it. There is an unconscious depth which consists of feeling and physical sensation, and possibly even ideas that we are not conscious of at all times. In relation to poetry, the thing that I have been discovering the last few days is that when I write, I generally say more, state the whole situation, the whole life situation, more completely than I am aware of. Now, because I have an eye for a conscious eye for verbal gimmicks that look interesting, that look intuitively interesting, and because I trust them, I leave them there and call those poems. But many, many years later, I'll go back to that poem and I'll find that that poem stated the whole situation, which it took me 20 years to understand earlier. Bob said that he was giving, Robert Duncan said he was, I think he said you were giving a reading the other day, or recently? And a line in the poem suddenly sprang out that you finally understood why it was there and what it had meant?
It came to him.
But then I didn't understand why it was there and what it meant. But it was the same thing. I mean, I suddenly realized I didn't understand why it was there and what it meant.
Something very similar happened to me when I was reading the other night, which is I had written very early, 1949 in a 48. At home, I had written a very short little poem. Today is my 23rd birthday. I feel ill. I am sick. I'm impotent spiritually, physically. I suddenly realized that my head is severed from my body. I realized it a few nights ago by myself, lying sleepless on the couch. Now, I always liked that poem. That was the first poem I sent to William, incidentally, and this is the poem that he responded to and said, yes, this is it. If you got any more like that, we'll make a book. Now, I thought that, well, that was a real interesting, at the time when I wrote it, I thought that's real interesting on account of, it's kind of goofy for someone to suddenly say, I realize my head is severed from my body. It's sort of poetic. And intuitively, I realized that there must be something interesting about that, because it's such an extreme statement and such an insane sort of statement. Yet if I'm making it, it must mean something. Nobody else would make that statement, so if I make that statement, maybe it'll mean something. And then to cover myself, because that statement is very abstract, I put in something detailed and concrete. I realized it by myself lying sleepless on the couch. And I thought, I realized it by myself sounded so naive and so silly, it was sort of like a primitive douanier was so charming. I realized it by myself lying sleepless on the couch. So I always liked that and thought that as sort of like a seed in poetry, but never understood it. And I never understood it until I took that poem completely, until I read it, got up there and read it. Yesterday, and realized what it meant. It meant, to put in words now, what it meant was that at that time, at the age of 20, my consciousness was absorbed in my head, in ideas, and that I was cut off from my feelings, cut off from my body, cut off from my sexuality, cut off from my emotions, cut off from my whole real existence, or not real existence, another aspect of my existence that I wasn't simply aware of. Now, this is sort of like a universal thing for almost everybody in the world. William says, man is lost in the world of his own head. So I had put that down intuitively. I suddenly realized that my head is separated from my body. I was thinking of it in a sort of ghostly, Dostoevskian way, or like a madman's way. I have no head. I have no head. Well, I realized now that was a real, clear, complete statement of what my situation was at that time. So, point as to like what is expansion of consciousness? You know, there's a greater awareness of like a whole, the whole of one's being, not only the idea system, and not only the conceptual system, and not only the sentiment and strong emotional rage, love, hang-up, obsession, but also the whole total sensation of the body. For us, putting that in the body is too simple way of saying it.
What are you hoping to accomplish by giving that poem to I'm not asking that antagonist.
Because I think your heads are all separated from your body, probably.
So what you're saying, in fact, is that we're all in the same spot.
I think we're all. The poem wouldn't be interesting to anybody else if we weren't all in the same spot.
Very different sense of what happens there. If when you say, my head is cut off from my body, you, and after you've written that down as testimony and had it as the situation you were in, you and anybody else, it isn't that their heads are cut from their body, but they are making sense and looking at that statement, and to do that, they have to say, they have to say first, my head is cut off from my body. How far, and in what way can I possibly imagine that of what I'm like? Now, then we're beginning to enter a question of perspectives. In some situation, yes, I think actually it was at points when, in your poetry, in your reading, when I was disaffected, something in me kept saying. But isn't there also the job of the imagination of going further, not just this, but the fact that it isn't a question that you were in a wrong position at all, but an incomplete one, because you could not only have this entirely and self-realizing, but there's also the funny potentiality at the same time that you would see this statement and have to do with the statement, my head is cut off from my body, the way anyone else does, Or why do we read? Why are case histories interesting? Or why are stories interesting? And what something happens that wouldn't conceivably happen in your world, except it happens. Yeah. So intensely you realize that it satisfies it, and you have some share. What share do you have in this statement? That's part of it. Just the same way, what share do I have in Lear, raving in the storm? What share do I have in my head is cut off my body? And so it isn't even time-bound. That statement could be thrown back, and an Egyptian could be opening it and saying my head. And actually, all sorts of... By the way, the other thing happened is that this head cut off from the body is a figure that you can see in all sorts of different ways, because it's a kinetic feeling human beings have, and it also stands for conditions that they... A primary human condition that can be rediscovered in each organism. And given that, certain things will be true. And can be realized.
For example, as Alan was saying that, or describing...
Can I speak once a moment?
No.
The thing that really amazes me is that words, when you were talking about what do you write, somehow words seem to be able to carry all that. In other words, you can write more than you know. You can put down in words sort of a magic formulae, almost, or a real formulae for what the situation is and what the feeling of life is, that while you're running it, you have no idea what it even means. And yet, if you have the sort of scoop or whatever it is, to be able to feel your way around.
Well, you can know what it means.
You can know.
Here's an instance.
I don't think you always know when you write it down. The problem is to ride those.
In speaking of this experience just now, you said, for example, when I read it yesterday. Now, one point is that is neither quote right nor wrong.
Yes.
The point is that your consciousness, if you're to hear what, if you're to know what he said, you must say he read it yesterday. If you're going to quote understand it, you say no, that's wrong. He didn't read it yesterday. He read it 2 days ago. You see. But you're conscious that he read it yesterday if you know what he said, rather than, quote, understand it. And the point, that's what is interesting to me about this mode that consciousness is given in words, or the occasion provided for in words, that exists beyond states of right and wrong. I've always been very interested in something Alan said in a poem, in one of the laughing gas sequence, when you ended, you say, everybody's right, I'll finish this poem in my next life. Which, in the context of the poems, say, well, I'll be reborn. But the point, this is also a very interesting statement of a way of feeling. It's a long sequence about the effects of having nitrous oxide, being given nitrous oxide when going to the dentist, and a whole sequence of senses of reality that then follow from it.
I was having a whole different series of different mental pictures of the universe, none of which I could finally say, I want to be there, I want to be there, as opposed to anything else that I knew. They all seem equally valid, but finally I see the world, and I think all of them are okay. But I can't make a choice among all of these anymore. I just have to wait till I'm reborn.
You see, there is a sense of life. We're talking about this in the particular class that I'm involved with, whether words are, quote, real, or whether they are referential to reality, or whether they are reality, are real. And it's my own feeling that they are. This is getting off the context, perhaps, of consciousness, but I don't think it is.
No, because, first place, where do they come from? They do not come out of you. They're given you, and they're already got in back of any word a whole area of human experience. If you just take a word like, a big word like cow, that's out of my first reader, like moo moo cow, they met. The moo and the cow are both, when you begin to find, that's why Charles insists on the business of going back and finding that word, because the word really does come to you from remote distances, and it's filled with experience. So you're not going to what's going to happen is that you're working with a material that's already magical, and you don't need any magic in this sense. So that when you say the woman came in the door, woman and door can be kept simple. And one of the problems in the poem is not to get things overcharged beyond what you mean. It's really to hold things back, because both woman and door can become so tremendous when the millions, it goes way back to the first sense of door, and then I'm sure the first sense of woman will drag that word door way back. these primal words. See, a word like author or sequence or events in a poem is really sort of fussy compared with a word like door or woman or house. Yes.
I'm just thinking of an example
here that I just got. Yeah. You know that they're baby carriages. You can't quote understand.
No. Actually, when I was reading, those were just sort of gibberish imagery that I was coming up with, garbage imagery. And I didn't have any idea when I wrote that exactly what that meant, or what it symbolically meant, or implied, or though I knew it had a feeling to it. But when I was reading it, I had a much stronger sense of what I was talking about when I said that they'd be carriages, particularly rubber dollar bills. I didn't know what I meant by rubber dollar bills when I said that. When I was reading it, I suddenly realized I was there setting forth my relation to the whole economic structure of the United States, the relation between my body and the economy of the United States. But I was just writing rubber dollar bills and trusting the language, trusting the gibberish, because the gibberish comes from my unconscious, which knows everything, I think. I mean, my unconscious, like in a dream, I think our unconscious is almost Jungian now, I'm getting. Like, the unconscious really knows everything that's going on, is completely aware of everything that's going on, and is sending messages, telegraph messages outside, rubber dollar bills, kid, rubber dollar bills. So I got a word, rubber dollar bills, and I think that's pretty silly, but it's pretty funny also, rubber dollar bills. It's not great, but it's funny anyway, so I left it in. It came out by itself, by association, mushroom association.
I keep looking.
I never knew what rubber dollar bills meant until I read it last night. I read that poem aloud many, many times. I never knew it referred to my relation to the economy, or you know, what the economy. I can't explain in great detail. I knew at the moment what it meant.
Now, the third proposition would I would not worry, but it I worry it in my own consciousness, distinguish between real and make-believe.
Four other kinds of art.
Or to recognize the beauty of words and phrases and create mental images. Is an image ever more than mental? Or what is mental? What is meant by that? I don't understand.
I don't think the guy who wrote that really understood the whole stuff.
No.
But he's writing poetry up there, recognizes the beauty of words and phrases, and creates several mental images, and then maybe in 20 years he'll understand what that really means. You know, he'll be like, is that what,
one of the ways of governing that, the fact that words are overcharged with meaning and experience, is to be sure you see then don't be careless of the woman came in the door, but be sure you see, and that will give it its locus. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to know, as Alan doesn't have to, you see, in a sense you said your picture is not seeing but hearing, but you did see, you both heard information as to what
the painting process there was truly verbal.
Yeah,
but
association, for instance, the automatic associations in order to build up the parallel of body and what he was looking at, of for instance, to wheelbarrow is not visual. At least I was sitting there trying to visualize it was verbal because what he really wanted to do was like Dali painting a paranoid landscape in which you see a face in a landscape. And it was not wrong because you wanted to actually find out what the form is trying to do when what he's looking at disappears and we see the genitalia, what you go through the list of the band and hidden parts of the body, and out of that comes the sunflower. And then it comes into one because the sunflower is the sunflower, and the operation. But yes, we can explain why these two couldn't come together, and it also explains, by the way, why beginning, I guess beginning really with Joyce, isn't it, that these words began to come back into the literary language, because certainly this was about the same time that people knew in psychological terms, Freud, not Jung, that the parts of the physical body, not only had the old gods been driven out and ridiculed, and finally today, Christ and Mary and God himself are so ridiculed that people smirk and say they don't believe in it, but by that, the genitalia that had been in the very beginning, by the way, identical with the images of these gods, had also been hidden, covered, and highly eroticized, because what comes in between is sort of an eros religion, but in the breakdown of that, in our present period of nothing shall happen in this century, none of these gods are to happen, and the genitals are not to happen, and then writers really feel the necessity to bring forward words that do not hide behind Latin, do not hide behind context of the doctor's office or the legal sentence, but it's an info, and they can only go so far. It's amazing to find how far Lawrence went, and how much, though, he needs the protection of the erotic circle, or else he's ridiculed, and he is. I mean, every person I've met who can still feel Lady Chatterley's Lover as a primal book, I have met 10 intelligent, advanced people who feel really it's very dated, and it isn't silly how people behaved in the 20s. And I'm talking about people that I meet, and I keep thinking I've got a screen that's going to kill off such people from my acquaintance. And something in me is ashamed and feels that it has to defend. And Lawrence himself, by the way, let's just skip me. Lawrence himself felt he had to defend what he could do there. Joyce does use, if you look at Molly Bloom, actually the words cock, cunt are in the same value as flower, hill. The police are after it. Flower, hill, flower, and rose and sun and so forth. And that is what, but the reason why there is an urgency, for instance,
the place where we really see a body in Kaddish, no such words mentioned. And that informs us even more about what these forbidden words, how important these forbidden words are, because we've been really prevented from seeing. They're used as swear words. We say God and Christ are used as swear words until you can, and in order to prevent you to get to them. And we use all those primal sexual words as swear words. And one of the things in writing is to be sure they are not swear words, but mean the genitals and the parts of the body that they come from. Yeah.
The old time kind of phrase that was thrown at me once about you got to get there in your skin, all of your, not one, not the only part behind. And I guess in a sense that same feeling is behind your poem about my head is covered with my body.
Yes.
Breakdown.
I didn't know it at the time. It was just sort of a wiggling in my face.
Well, the problem that comes up for me is when, if there is a breakdown, or I don't know if there's any easy solution to it, how do you get it together in a poem?
Well, the poem necessarily doesn't have to get it together. The poem can just sort of state the problem. But, I mean, if you get that far, it gets
so you're not really anxious to get there in the skin. You're going to leave parts behind.
I'm anxious to get there in the skin, but like poetry is one of the reasons
why
I don't know the answer to your question.
I know an answer to your question because sometime around the same it really is about the same time, and this doesn't have to do with this of chronology, but Alan and I are somewhat close in age. I was going through struggle in a different way. That is, I was feeling guilty because I wanted to satisfy my mentality in the poem, and everything around said, "Oh, that's pretty terrible. You're getting awful mental, and don't you?" And then I suddenly realized, "Well, now look, I don't really feel it's wrong if my heart gets into it, and if my nervous system gets into it. Why in the world can't my brain have a little participation in this total dance?" And at that time I wrote a little sort of piece that this was in Banya Bufar, you remember, I wrote a piece to picture before there ever was such a conflict, what was it like when the brain and everything got together and were one total organism. So this was in order to have to make such a picture, I must have had some such sense as my brain is cut from my body. But what of course interests me is that Alan's interpretation is that the body had been left out, and so the alternative is to leave the brain out and live in the body. I mean, like I've been shut out of my body is really what he felt, and now I'll leave my head and go into my body, leaving the same little membrane between the two, and the I means my brain will go into my body. Well, my picture was my brain's going to remain in my head the brain doesn't see. I wanted to know more about, but it is a physical organ, and I guess just along with everything else, it's become one of, it's also scorned. Right. All we mentioned, you know, like he's brainy, and you've said something pretty awful about a person. You've separated him from every other human being as if there has been some sort of horrible sort of, my, oh, and he does that? Probably in private, too. Yeah.
I think so, right.
When you say that consciousness is that awareness of yourself, physical, emotional, sensational, mental, in relation to the environment, to the whole universe, to the secrets.
Well, I think they're one, finally. But the self and the universe are one. There's no inside and outside.
But we didn't.
Consciousness without feeling.
Well,
thought without feeling.
But you are conscious of your consciousness.
Yeah. consciousness of consciousness, drug sensations. That's just the way I'm using the word right at the moment. And recently, the last week, I've been using another word, feeling, to indicate another area of what might be called consciousness, but which I'm not calling consciousness. Feeling, that's another thing. Feeling involves the whole body. That's the way I use it. But, you know, we're all using consciousness slightly differently.
I use consciousness just of what you're aware of at the point. At the
yes.
point. I
mean,
just, and that can be, for instance, involve the total system, and, but usually you're, for instance, you're very seldom aware of what's going on in the inside of your body except for the messages that have to do with disorders. And you can be, because usually orders within the body are felt as a total tonic, but then this would be consciousness. But by the way, we're in a territory that has not at all been straightened out by psychologists who've been trying to deal with consciousness and unconsciousness and preconscious. When Brother Antoninus came along with the big unconscious and inferred that some people had little ones, and I thought, gee, I got a little one, and we'll play back at that game. You got a big one, I got a little one. And it turns out to be an unconscious? I mean, I don't know. I mean, gee, when you get to be 40-year-old boys, you get to some peculiar games. I went and got a book that was written by Freudian to outline the and try to say what were the different ideas present at the present time in Freudian analysis about the conscious, the unconscious, the id, the ego, the preconscious. Well, when you got through, and when they got through, they observed that there was a slight difficulties in every possible direction. So these weren't even weasel words. They had so many diagrams, and the one who was having the most fun of all was Freud, because he'd say, oh no, it couldn't be that way, and he'd draw another diagram, and 20 people would run out trying to make that diagram work, while he was saying, no, I think we'll just scrap it and we'll call that the id, but then if it's the id, it must be shaped differently in a way he is, but this is like running, you know, the latest Picasso must be the Picasso, and is the next one going to be wrong or right or something? Because